Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. My second guest today is an award-winning journalist, and in light of recent and very public events, Jessica Bennett's new book is very timely. It's often laugh-out-loud funny, to the point, and it's illustrated. But most importantly, it takes a solution-oriented look at sexism in today's workplace. And if you think that doesn't exist anymore, you definitely need to stay tuned. First, I'm very pleased to welcome Dr. Alan Hamilton back to the show. He joined us a few years ago with his first book, The Scalpel and the Soul, and he's back with us today with his latest book. Let me tell you a little bit about him. He's a neurosurgeon, a horse trainer, a developer of equine-assisted learning programs, and the author of Zen Mind, Zen Horse. He's also a medical script consultant for the hit television series Grey's Anatomy, which of course is filmed up here in Seattle, and he raises horses on a ranch in Tucson, Arizona. His new book is called Lead With Your Heart, Lessons from a Life with Horses. Dr. Alan Hamilton, welcome to the show.
It's nice to be back, Vicki.
So I want to just begin, if we can, with a little bit about your background, a little bit more about your background, because it's very interesting. And you began life as a janitor. I'm assuming this was to put you through school at Harvard.
No, actually, I was out of work. It was a recession, and I couldn't find a job, so I started work as a janitor part-time, and I couldn't make ends meet, so I got another gig cleaning out a veterinary hospital. And as I was mopping floors and that sort of thing, I could see through the glass they were doing surgery, so I got kind of interested, and I started mopping the floor a little bit more outside the operating rooms, I guess, than anywhere else,
right.
And finally, one of the surgeons took pity on me and said, look, if you get your chores done, then I'll invite you into the operating room and teach you how to hold retractors so you can watch the surgery. And that led to me wanting to go into medicine and into brain surgery. And one thing led to another. So I guess being a janitor was the natural path to going to Harvard.
I love that story, Alan, because you've been voted by your peers, your neurosurgical peers, as one of America's best doctors for the last 18 consecutive years. I just love that story, how that began for you. You've also been selected as one of the leading intellects of the 21st century. And you have this great balance because, you know, being a lover of horses myself, I understand the connection there. But tell our listeners why you're so interested and so passionate about horses.
Well, you know, I think neurosurgery is, you know, all stainless steel and great precision and CT and MR scans. And, you know, it's sort of the left brain part of my life. And then coming home and working and training horses is sort of the right brain, because everything's in, you know, horse training is based on intuition, on the emotional connection with the horse. And it's a very wonderful way of connecting. And over the 30 years or so that I've been training horses, they've taught me a great deal about myself, and that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, is because I think they teach us great spiritual and emotional lessons that we can apply in our lives. So the book is really about 112 lessons and how what they meant from horses and how they translate into everyday life.
Mm-hmm. And I should explain to listeners, because, you know, this was pure coincidence, but last week we talked with Linda Kahanoff.
I know Linda very well, yeah.
You do? Well, she does equine-assisted therapy and training, learning programs, and she wrote the book, The Five Rules of a Master Herder, a Revolutionary Model for Socially Intelligent Leadership. This is an entirely different book, but the correlation between horses is still there. So it was purely coincidental that this happened. I love your book. It's full of illustrations, beautiful illustrations and life lessons and the best quotes from some of ancient wisdom and modern wisdom. I'm wondering why, tell me how the book came into fruition, how you decided to develop it this way.
Well, I sort of always had this feeling ever since I was a young kid that horses were able to teach us things that we might not have access to through other ways. So if you think about it, horses are nonverbal. They tune into how your emotional energy, how you're holding your body, whether you're focusing on them, and that sort of thing. So I always had the feeling like they were these sages, you know, like Zen masters, but you know, they would wait till you had the right question, you know, so sort of you go out to the round pen and they'd say, so you think you're ready, grasshopper? We shall see, you know? And so bit by bit, I started, you know, training first, but then there'd be all these little things I'd want to remind myself of. So I'd write them down on these 3x5 index cards, and then after a while, they just started piling up, and I thought, oh, you know, it'd be nice to put these things together because they don't really relate. They certainly relate to horses, but the more important thing is they relate to real life, to everyday life and the things that we do at home with our families, with our spouses, with our coworkers. And so they shed a lot of light on those issues and values.
Right, right. So tell us a little bit about Rancho Bosque. Tell me how to pronounce that. But
Rancho Bosque.
Bosque.
Ranch in the woods, yep.
Ranch in the woods. I like that. So you founded this with your wife, correct?
Correct.
And so what do you do at Rancho Bosque?
Well, we do, you know, it's 17 acres, and we obviously have our own horses. We raise Lipizzans, those big dressage, beautiful dressage horses. But we also take in horses for training, and then we run a number of courses. For example, we run a course for cancer survivors. We just finished running another course for the business and law school on negotiating skills, because most of
really?
Your negotiating is nonverbal. And believe me, when you're negotiating with a 1,200-pound you know, client, you learn to figure out what's the deal breaker.
Yes,
being so there. I also teach a class for medical students on their nonverbal body language at the bedside. And so, you know, my wife's a clinical psychologist, so she does a lot of equine-assisted therapy because it's very important. Sometimes people have a hard time putting into words what they're feeling, but they don't have a hard time when they're working with horses. It's very interesting to me. We've done a lot of work with people of victims of domestic violence, PTSD, veterans, substance abusers, you know, grieving families that are grieving loss of a loved one, and so on. And every step of the way, you'll always find something from horses which will translate into their lives. It's sort of amazing to me.
Yeah. You write extensively. You've done a book, maybe two books on horse training. I'm not
yep.
sure. Yeah, two books on horse training. This book is entirely different, but we'll get to that in just a moment. I want to ask you this, because you say working with a horse is never about the horse. It is always about you. So tell us what you mean by that.
Well, kind of going back to something I just was remarking on, which is when you're working with a horse, when you get down into the real detail of connecting with that horse, the thing that holds the horse back is not the horse. It's you. It's your ability to understand the horse, communicate with the horse, partner with the horse, see the world through his eyes. And so, you know, every single time you are stopped or stumped by a problem with the horse, you have to remind yourself, it's not the horse, it's me. And I've got to figure out what I'm doing that's contributing to the issue.
Right. And you mentioned that you work, one of the things that you work with, and you talk about this in the book, is negotiation. So what do we learn from working with a horse about negotiation? I know I've been there many times,
yeah.
Trust me.
Well, let me give the listeners an example. Okay, so you have a horse, and he's on the end of a lead rope. And the easiest thing seems to be, okay, I want the horse to go this way. I'm going to pull on the lead rope. So the horse doesn't want to go with you. So the horse begins to resist. Our natural impulse is, I'll just pull harder on the lead rope. Horse resists some more. You resist more. Now you're spending a lot of energy resisting each other, but you're not going anywhere. And then you have to think about the whole proposition. Wait a minute. I'm getting into a resistance game with a 1,200-pound creature that if he makes up his mind that he wants to leave, there's very little in the world I could do to physically stop them. So then you stop yourself and you say, wait a minute, I don't want to get into these lines of resistance. What I want to do is find a way for this horse to flow with me, to compromise and move with me of his own volition. And if you think about that, that's what negotiation is. I have to figure out what is it that person across from the table wants. And yes, I could escalate and say, if you don't give me this, I'm going to take away that. But, you know, think about that negotiation as opposed to what is it that you want that will make you partner up with me so we can flow together. So I talk about lines of resistance versus curves of compromise, because horses love to move on curves, and that's when they're much more inclined to flow with you. So, you know, I use that every day at work. I say to myself, if I created a line of resistance, and where am I looking for the curve of compromise that I can get everybody to have consensus and flow with me?
Yeah, makes perfect sense. Well, we're going to look at some of these lessons, some of these other lessons in the book when we come back. We'll take a very quick break, and we'll be back with Dr. Alan Hamilton. His book is called Lead With Your Heart, Lessons from a Life with Horses. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Please stay with us.
Judy, I'm just trying to find and keep the dream of horses. And the song she wrote was Judy and the Dream of Horses. Dream of horses. Dream of horses.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
It's me, your heart. High blood pressure is serious, and if you think I'm just going to keep ticking away, you're wrong. I can quit whenever I want, but I like my job. Just treat me better. Maybe we can do some exercise on occasion? After all, we're in this together.
Don't let your heart quit on you. High blood pressure can lead to a stroke, heart attack, or death. Get yours to a healthy range before it's too late. For help keeping yours at a healthy range, text PRESSURE to 97779. A message from the American Heart Association, the American Stroke Association, and the Ad Council.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, the founder of Escape to Peace, Carol Loya. She opened the Bellevue Center this month to help victims of sex trafficking in King County. We'll also hear from therapist Shira Block on relationship topics including emotional cheating, catfishing, and limerence, a term used to describe infatuated love. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific Time right here on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM. Listen online at 1150kknw.com.
Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, bringing you guests ranging from authors and filmmakers to explorers and dreammakers.
There's a reason they invented the internet. It's called 1150kknw.com.
And welcome back, everybody. I am pleased to have Dr. Alan Hamilton back in the studio, talking with us today. He joined us a few years ago with Scalpel and the Soul, which won quite a prestigious award, didn't it, Alan? And in fact, all of your books have, I think.
Well, I've been very lucky. I won the Nautilus Gold Award, which, a lot more prestigious, illustrious people than I have won, like the Dalai Lama. And so I was very touched that they thought so highly of the book about spirituality.
Yeah, it's amazing. And what amazes me is how you have the time to do all this. You're also script consultant for Grey's Anatomy, the TV series. I mean, you wear a lot of different hats. How do you keep yourself balanced? I'm guessing you're going to say your horses do that for you.
I know my wife says when things get out of sorts, she immediately sends me to the barn and says, go work with a horse. So there must be something to the self-adjusting.
Well, I was going to say it's funny because, you know, most teenagers are a handful to deal with, right? And My father would tell everyone, Vicky is a delight to come home to. And it's because I had my horse. I wasn't into all the other stuff that teenagers
yeah.
were. I'm sure I caused grief in other ways, mind you. But okay, so let's look at one of the things that I think is important. Well, there are a lot of important lessons in this book. Letting go is something that's very difficult to do with people. And again, because you're working with the animal, you have to learn this flow and this letting go. So talk to us about that, if you would.
Well, one of the things that will destroy a relationship, and it's just as true for humans as it is with horses, is when you have an agenda. So if you go in to start training that horse and you're looking at your watch, so to speak, you know, you're saying, oh, I got 20 minutes to do this, so let me hurry up. And that horse immediately detects that you've lost your integrity with them because they can sense you're not focused on them. You're focused on trying to get something out of them. So very often with a horse, it's when you're so attached to the outcome that you're going to run into problems. In fact, the only time I've ever been seriously injured with a horse was when I've been so intent on proving something with a horse to a group of spectators at a clinic or something that I'm really getting very predatory, and I'm trying to say, I want you to do this so I can show these people how this is done, rather than go, you're not quite ready today for that. So.
Or when you jump on your horse and he's asleep. I read that in the book.
Yes, exactly. And so one of the things that you learn is, hey, the goal isn't as important as the relationship. And when you let go, everything seems to start flowing of its own. And it's a very hard thing to do. But with the horse, you can see it physically. We have time for a quick story?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. So I'll tell you a quick story. I was up in the Rincon Mountains, which is the east part of outside of Tucson, and we were coming up over a ridge. And as we come up over this mountainous ridge, from below we can see that on the other side of this there's an enormous storm. And we're at the top of these really treacherous rocks, and the storm sweeps in. It's snowing. It's blowing. We can't see a thing in front of our faces. And I'm going, you know, we're in a tremendous pickle here. We can't figure out how to get off this mountain. And I kept hearing in my head, just let go of the reins, just let go. And I kept thinking, what does this mean? And I kept just let go. And finally, I just let go of the reins. I just knotted them up and I put them over the horn of the saddle. And my horse, Sonny, just picked his way through this storm all the way down. I had no idea how he did it. And then all of a sudden, about an hour and a half later, I heard this clump, 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 and I could tell that his hoofs were on the wooden bridge that led to the trail to the parking lot.
Mm.
And it was just this lesson in, you know, you don't have as much control as you think. And,
right.
and letting go is often the way that you go from a breakdown to a breakthrough.
Right, right. I think they teach you. Animals, if you build a bond with them, teach you a lot about relationships. And one of the things you talk about in the book is agendas, having relationships with agendas. What have you learned from working with horses about that?
They're not that important. I mean, I wish I had learned these lessons a lot earlier. I think sometimes back to when my kids were teenagers, you know, and you'd have the typical, you know, conversations where they'd be telling you that they think this is right or they want to do this, and you'd be going, no, you're not going to do this, you know, not while you're under my roof. The sort of typical conversation. And when I think back, I wouldn't really be listening to them. I'd be waiting for them to take a breath so I could tell them what I thought was right. And, you know, as you work with horses, you learn to sort of let go of that. What you think is right isn't what's important. What's happening is important. And so I learned over time, a little bit too late sometimes, but I learned over time to really listen. So, for example, the average patient, when they go to a doctor, he or she is going to be interrupted on average, believe it or not, within 29 and a half seconds after they start talking.
Mm.
Okay, so you come in and you say, well, I have this headache. And you go, well, when did it start? As opposed to letting them tell you their story. So one of the things I learned from horses as a doc was sit back, let the patient tell you their story. They will tell you what's important. They will tell you the details. You just have to be patient and give them the time to really tell you. And so it's all those little aspects of life where we go, letting go of the agenda is what allows you to break through and to really show that person or that agency that you're committed to truly listening to what their needs are. And that changes you. That gives you a lot of ability to communicate, but also gives you a huge amount of information.
Right, right. While we're talking about relationships, you say horse riding, being with horses, is a respite from feeling like we have to lie all the time. You say we all lie, and people lie to each other a lot.
Oh, boy.
Explain that to us.
Well, we are born liars. I mean, that's the unfortunately, you know, we most of the time we don't even know that we're lying. Most of the time we're lying to ourselves. A lot of times we're lying to other people. The interesting about the horse is he doesn't care what you say. You know, he cares, how do you feel when you're here? What am I reading in your body? Okay, so a lot of times people will come and they'll be, naturally, there are people who are afraid of horses. And I'll go, you don't have to hide that from him because he can tell.
Right.
So let's work. Are you safe? Or do you feel comfortable working 25 feet away from the horse? Yeah, okay, that's where we start. Because there's no point in lying to the horse. And it's this refreshing thing of the horse accepts me for who I am. Another beautiful example is kids with autism. Kids with autism often have a hard time communicating, expressing themselves verbally, and looking at people's faces for the emotional content. Well, the horse doesn't care what you say, and he doesn't need you to look at his face. So suddenly, kids with autism, they can work with horses because all of those disadvantages have disappeared. And the horse is saying, I can read you non-verbally. I don't need you to look at my face for me to read you emotionally. I can read the energy off your body. And so autistic kids often have these very natural, immediate, spontaneous relationships with horses where human beings prove very difficult.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I've seen phenomenal work done with horses and kids with autism. Absolutely phenomenal work. You talk about, nonverbal communication, and you say that you can slow down a horse simply by modifying your breathing.
Yeah, I actually have a video posted on my website, which is allenhamilton.com, 2 A's, 2 L's, and you'll see it. On there, I have a video of a horse that's been just bitten by, I think it's a bee or something, which got him really riled up. And I just show how by slowing your breathing down and slowing yourself down, you will calm the horse down. And, you know, you say, well, okay, that's fine and dandy. That's great for horses. But I use exactly the same technique when I run to a code, when they're resuscitating a patient. I don't want to run in there and go, you know, tell me what's going on. I never go in there that way. I mm-hmm. always come in with my breathing very quiet, my voice very soft, and I say, okay, so fill me in on what's going on, because immediately I establish that I'm calming the atmosphere down and that I want everybody to have this sense of we're in control of this, we're in command of this, and we're going to save this person. Maybe we won't, but it certainly isn't going to be helped along by panic. The best possible tool I can give everybody is we're going to be calm and methodical and professional about every step of this to save this person.
Yeah. I realized when I was going through your book how much I learned from horses without even realizing. You just brought all this to the page, and beautifully so. Short little essays, some of them are just a page or page and a half long, and as I said earlier, beautiful illustration. In the chapter on, or the essay on combining energy, you say, we live in a world where there is energy in us, and we share that energy between ourselves and all the life forms around us. Talk to us about that.
Well, you know, in a way, I think the horse is a messenger. The horse is saying, you know, you knew how to be in connection with nature and the life around you. You had that skill. You've lost it, but it's still there. And the horse says, I'll show you. You can change how fast I move around. 35 feet away. I can look at a horse in a pasture an acre away from me, and if I pick out that black and white horse, that's the horse I'm going to collect. That horse's head will come up and the other horses will continue grazing. And you say, how is that possible? Because that horse feels my focus on him. And then you say, well, that doesn't happen. You go, sure it does. When was the last time you were at a cocktail party and you suddenly had this feeling that somebody was staring at you? And you turned around, and there they were staring at you. And you go, well, what was it that made you turn around? And the answer was you felt the energy when they were staring at you. So we have these abilities, and the horse is just saying, be mindful. You're in an energetic conversation with the universe around you, whether you want to recognize it and hear it, or you want to ignore it and be deaf to it. But the conversation is going on. And when it comes to energy and emotion, the horse is saying, you can link these two. You can lose a lot of emotional energy, or you can understand that they're separate. I can put more energy on a horse without having to get mad at him. I don't have to go, you son of a gun, get going. That just confuses the horse.
Mm-hmm.
The horse is going, why are you angry at me? If you wanted me to just go a little faster, then just give me a little bit more energy and I'll move. And so, you know, the horse is teaching you, hey, be mindful when you are using your, you know, your anger to get more energy. You know, hey, stay out of that. That's my parking spot. Well, I don't need to get emotional about it. I can just apply more energy to make it happen.
Right, right. I wonder, we've only got a couple of minutes left here, but I wonder if you'd share the story of Otto, your grandfather's horse, because your grandfather wouldn't have been here for that, but for that horse, which means you probably wouldn't have been here, but for
right.
that
well,
horse.
He saved me. I grew up in a home with domestic violence, and my grandfather took us and, you know, raised me. And my grandfather was a cavalry officer, and his favorite horse was Otto, and he went away in World War One. And they were coming over a ridge, and as they came over, they were suddenly hit by mortar fire. And Otto literally reared up to take the full brunt of the mortar shell, and his legs were blown off, and my grandfather had to shoot him right then and there. But Otto saved his life, and my grandfather was awarded this incredible medal for bravery by the emperor himself. And as a kid, I was fascinated by it, you know, this beautiful, shiny metal and everything. And my grandfather would always take the metal out and show me the picture of Otto underneath. And he would say, don't forget that we all owe our life to this horse.
Mm.
That he sacrificed himself to save me.
Right, right. Well, you say the horse is a metaphor for the spirit. I wonder what's a final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with today, Alan?
I think that the horse is trying to say to us, we have a chance to really connect to each other and connect to nature around us and the world around us. And those skills are all there. We just have to be mindful of them and work on them. But they're all at our fingertips.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for being with us. Beautiful book. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Great talking with you again. I know listeners.
Likewise, Vicki. Thanks so much.
Yeah, and listeners can find out more about Dr. Alan Hamilton and his books at alanhamilton.com. That's A-L-L-A-N Hamilton.com. And this book we talked about today, Lead With Your Heart, Lessons from a Life with Horses. This would make an awesome gift book with the holidays coming up. All right, please stay tuned. We'll be back with Jessica Bennett in our next section. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Let's see if I guess that this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicki St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicki partners with people just like you at the exact level you need. Whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services. If you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicki today. Email Vicki at VickiSt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicki and her work at VickiSt.Clair.com.
Oh, yeah, that could work.
you love wildlife? Then make a real difference by helping PAWS care for sick and injured wild animals. Volunteers help feed and clean the animals until they are well enough to return to the wild. Sign up today and help save a wild life. No experience necessary. All training is provided. Visit PAWS.org or call 425-787-2500.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to the Northwest School of Animal Massage, we cover the world of animals. This week, October 30th, it's an encore presentation of Harmonic and Energy Shifting Sunday with Jude and Paul Ponton from Whispering Dragon Center in Seattle. Hear them in the studio with their acutonic forks, Tibetan bowls and bells, Pua and Didge, doing remote sessions for listeners and their animal friends. You can benefit from the energy just from listening. Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair.
Wherever you go, Alternative Talk 1150 is here for you.
And welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. We are joined now by our next guest who's joining us via Skype. Her name is Jessica Bennett. She's an award-winning journalist and critic who writes about women, sexuality, and culture. She's a columnist at the New York Times and former columnist for Time.com, and also a contributing editor for Sheryl Sandberg's nonprofit, LeanIn.org. And there she's the co-founder and curator of the Lean In Collection, a photo partnership with Getty Images to change the way women are depicted in stock photography. Jessica Bennett, welcome.
Thank you.
And I want to say the name of your new book is called Feminist Fight Club, an office survival manual for a sexist workplace. I love this on the bottom. You say, book is 21% more expensive for men.
Yes, it's not really 21% more expensive for men, but that is making a point, highlighting the wage gap.
Right. Well, let's talk about that wage gap. First of all, though, I think that sets the tone for this book. It is part hilarious. It's very serious as well. Full of facts and information, but most importantly, it's full of solutions for those people who are facing sexism in the workplace. And I was quite shocked to see the difference between what a white woman earns versus an African-American versus Hispanic. It was quite staggering. And all of them, without saying, earned less than men. So talk to us about that, if you would.
Yeah, the figures are pretty depressing. So on average, the average American woman makes 79 cents to the male dollar. And that's looking at across races. But when you dig down and look by race, African American women make just 69 cents and Latina women make 59 cents. Now, of course, there are all sorts of arguments about the wage gap and the fact that, you know, women may take time off to care for children, and perhaps that's what accounts for it. Or maybe they're choosing lower paying fields like teaching or nursing, and perhaps that's what accounts for it. But even when you dig into the data and you compare side by side men and women without children who went to the same universities in the same fields, women still make 93% what men do. So it's pretty depressing.
It is. And especially since, as you point out in the book, women are graduating from college and earning advanced degrees in higher numbers than their male counterparts.
Yeah. You know, they're earning more PhDs, more master's degrees, more undergraduate degrees, and in fact, getting higher grades. So there's something happening in which women are excelling and then they reach the workforce and suddenly a gap begins. And for a long time, that has been attributed to all sorts of different factors. But I think that what we have to realize and what these wage gap figures show is that some of it is just blatant discrimination.
Right. And it is surprising to me, having, you know, I've been in the workforce for a long, long, long time now. I do still run into it a little, but I've never been afraid of standing up for myself. And that's not always the case with some women, and we'll talk about how to handle that later. I understand you ran into it a little at Newsweek and Tumblr. Now, one of those, Newsweek is kind of old school, and Tumblr I think of as, you know, a new digital company, and yet you still experience sexism there. Was there different kinds of sexism going on at those two places?
Yeah, you know, when I was at Newsweek, which is where I began my career, and I was there for a number of years and worked my way up from intern, a lot of what we saw was this very systemic old boys network form of sexism in which women didn't see their stories published as frequently. Or, you know, I at one point found out that a male colleague with the same title and job as I had was making about $10,000 more. And this was a place where, in fact, in 1970, the women of Newsweek sued the company for gender discrimination. And this was the first lawsuit of its kind back then. So this was an old boys network that had a very long and very strong history of sexism. Certainly it wasn't as overt in my era. People would never dare tell the women that they couldn't write or they were not allowed to be writers, which was what the women of the past were told. And yet it still persisted. Now, fast forward to Tumblr. You know, I got tired of working in old media, thought I would go into new media and be in this really progressive, lovely environment. And on some level it was, you know, this was a progressive environment. There were all-you-could-eat snacks. You got to bring your dog to work every day. All of these kind of hilarious perks that come along with working in Silicon Valley or tech-type fields. But at the same time, it was a new organization. It was run by men still, white men largely. And there weren't structures in place to solve for many of these things. There was no HR department at one point. So when I first took the job, I was told that I would be the editor of the department that I was launching. And then I arrived and realized that, in fact, I was actually reporting to another man who was acting as the editor. And so it was subtleties like that. And in the end, you know, when I was in meetings trying to convey what we were working on, the people in those meetings would end up looking towards the man anyway. Mm. So these things are not always overt. This is certainly not the sexism of my mother's generation, but it still persists, even if it's subtle.
Yeah, you mentioned how, you know, women in the 60s certainly weren't encouraged to write. They weren't allowed to write. I remember talking with Gail Sheehy, and she desperately wanted to be a writer and, of course, wrote Passages, which made it into the Library of Congress, one of the best, most important books of the decade, of the century, actually. And she was relegated to writing about cooking and kitchen type things, and it took her a long time to break in. It's you know, and we kind of take it for granted now that that's all been taken care of. But as you said, it is going on still. So look, let's do this for the purposes of our conversation. And your book, let's define what you mean by feminism. And I bring this up because, you know, we know what's been happening in the media lately with the political campaigning going on, and there's been a lot of sexist remarks, and then when women have spoken up, there's been anti-feminist backlash. There's this issue, it seems, around the word feminism. So tell us what you mean by feminism for the purposes of our conversation.
Yeah, you know, the definition, the dictionary definition of a feminist is a person who believes in equality between the sexes. So as Gloria Steinem once said, you're either a feminist or a misogynist. So in my mind, you know, I think that every sane human should be a feminist. And you don't need to be a feminist because it's the right thing to do. You can be a feminist because, in fact, companies are more successful when they have more women on their boards. Mm-hmm. And if we could equalize the playing field across industries in the United States, the GDP would rise by 26%. You know, there's a real business case to be made for equality or feminism, whichever one you're comfortable saying. It's not just about doing the right thing.
Right, right. And some companies are taking advantage of that, and they're seeking more women, but it's not the norm by any means. The book is called Feminist Fight Club. So tell us how this came to into fruition. It's quite an interesting story. The secret club.
Yes. So at the time when I began my career at Newsweek and was struggling and facing a lot of these issues, you know, it was very easy to turn inward and think to myself, well, maybe I just didn't pitch that article in the right way. Maybe they don't think that I'm that good of a writer, and that's why I didn't get the assignment. And it was only through talking to other young women at Newsweek and elsewhere that we started to realize that these issues were very collective. We were all experiencing them together, but we had never spoken of it before. So My Feminist Fight Club is a real club. It's a group of women that I began meeting with around that time. There were a dozen or so of us, and we all worked in creative industries, in film, in publishing, and we would meet. We would gather every month, and we would talk about the challenges we were facing, and we would try to come up with some constructive ways to overcome them. And it was called a fight club, jokingly, because the first rule was that we didn't talk about the group outside of the group. And at the time, that was very real. There were women in the group who felt that if word got out that they were in what was essentially a modern-day consciousness-raising group, they would be penalized in their offices. And so that was the first rule. We didn't talk about the club. But of course, over time, things have gotten a little bit better for women, and the time has come to talk about the club.
And so you're doing that through the book, obviously. I love the way you put it together. It is quite, I mean, I laughed out loud several times when I was reading this. But you also provide a lot of solutions for women who, you know, need help getting through this nightmare. Because it is a nightmare if they work in a sexist environment. I think we'll go to break a little early, and then when I come back, we can dive into the book and I won't have to interrupt you.
Perfect.
My guest is award-winning journalist Jessica Bennett. Her book is called Feminist Fight Club, an Office Survival Manual for a Sexist Workplace. And it's described as a manifesto, part manifesto and part guide. And we're going to dive into this when we come back from break. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Please stay with us.
Can you hear my voice this time? This is my fight song. Take back my life song. Prove I'm all right song. My power's turned off.
Hi. I found a toy dinosaur over on the playground by Smith Street. It had this phone number on it, and, well, I just wanted to make sure the dinosaur made it back to its little owner.
Yeah, hi. I think I found your kid's stuffed animal near the swing set. Just wanted to call. I'm sure she misses it.
I know my son gets super attached to the smallest things, even a fire truck, and I'd be happy to drop it off. The toy was a little muddy, so I cleaned it up, and it's good to go whenever you're around.
When I found the little sippy cup, I just had to give you a call. It's for a kid, you know?
We'd do anything for kids. Yet 1 in 6 children in the U.S. struggle with hunger. Help end childhood hunger and give all of our kids the meals they need to grow. Learn how at feedingamerica.org. Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, the founder of Escape to Peace, Carol Loya. She opened the Bellevue Center this month to help victims of sex trafficking in King County. We'll also hear from therapist Shira Block on relationship topics including emotional cheating, catfishing, and limerence, a term used to describe infatuated love. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific Time right here on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM. Listen online at 1150kknw.com.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, bringing you topics ranging from meditation to conservation, business and careers, to health and wealth.
Conversation you won't find on the rest of the dial. Alternative Talk, 1150.
Welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. My guest in this segment is Jessica Bennett. She's the author of Feminist Fight Club. And it's about, she shares in the book how women in New York formed a secret club without men and without fighting to combat sexism and redefine sexist archetypes. So we want to take a look at a couple of those archetypes in just a moment. But I want to look, first of all, at Jessica, at the ways that we as women get in our own way. You know, I was really disappointed when, I don't want to get into the politics, but, you know, we've seen this. If you've only got to look on Twitter to see how hateful people have been about both candidates. But when Donald Trump called Hillary Clinton a nasty woman, there was a group who jumped on board and said, hell yes, we're nasty women and we're powerful. And then there's a whole other group of women who just went the other way. So talk to us a little bit about what do you see when you're talking with people as being the biggest step in, the biggest obstacle we put in our way?
Well, I actually found very little of the pro nasty woman comment in my, maybe that exists in my sheltered internet world, but the backlash to it and the reclaiming of the word nasty was just huge, from t-shirts and songs and mock music videos to Vox, a reporter there, did a fake perfume ad for nasty women that was hilarious. So I actually saw a lot of really positive outcomes come out of that. But I think that certainly, you know, we're talking about a world in which women have been told for hundreds and hundreds of years that they are not meant to be in power. And so as a result, I think that sometimes we internalize this belief. You know, we hear this buzzword imposter syndrome these days. This is the idea that when you're in a position of power, or perhaps you get a promotion, or you're in a big meeting, and you feel like you don't belong to be there, or perhaps you don't deserve it. Sometimes people describe feeling like a fraud. And this is something that happens more frequently among women. And why? Well, because for so long we've been told we are not meant to be there. And so I think that there are very real forms of female self-sabotage when it comes to leadership at work. But again, it's tricky because it's not women's fault that they may feel insecure or perhaps self-sabotage in some of these scenarios. It's because for so long we've been told we are not supposed to be there.
Right, right. Let's look at a couple of words that I don't like these words, and I hear them, you know, I've heard them over the years about various people. And you talk about this in the book. You talk about words that stigmatize women while challenging their competence. And those words might be, you know, nag and psycho and she's aggressive where he's assertive, or he's a leader, she's bossy. So talk to us about the power of those words.
Yeah, you know, there are these very real double standards that we hold for men and women in power. And Hillary Clinton is a very perfect example of this in this current campaign. You know, she's criticized for being too aggressive. Well, what does aggression really mean? It means taking a hard line on things, being decisive, essentially possessing the qualities that should be required of a leader. But those same behaviors would never be described as aggressive in a man. They might be described as assertive or decisive, but not in a bad way. Things like shrill. You know, Hillary Clinton is frequently criticized for the tone of her voice. Shrill. Well, shrill is a word that, if you dig into the research, you will find is used twice as frequently to describe female voices as it is for men. So with some of these things, pushy, bossy, a nag, we are describing behavior that wouldn't be thought of in those negative terms if it were coming from a man.
Right. I flashed back here to Margaret Thatcher when she was, she was one of the most powerful women in the world. The first thing they did was, you know, take her behind closed doors and get her to drop the shrillness from her voice.
Right. You know, women have to do things and bend over backwards and balance a line that men simply don't. In Hillary Clinton's case, you know, she needs to be assertive but not aggressive. She needs to be warm and nurturing because that's how we expect women to behave, but not so warm and nurturing or nice that we think she's a pushover. All of these things, it's like two steps forward, one step back. And the reality is that we're not scrutinizing men at all on these similar standards.
It's very true. It is very true. So one of the things that, you know, it's important in today's world, whether we like it or not, there has to be a certain amount of self-promotion. And this is something that I think many women in particular are uncomfortable with, because we're, you know, certainly in my culture, people don't like it when people self-promote. They're seen as braggarts and big-headed and, you know, you name all those names. And it's a little more prevalent in America. You know, women are a little more comfortable, I think, about doing it here. But there's still many out there who are not comfortable doing it. You have a great solution in the book. Tell us what that is.
Yeah. So this is a really tricky subject because nobody likes a bragger, whether they're female or male. And yet, so much of our modern workplace is surrounded by needing to get credit for the things you're doing. So in my industry, for example, I need eyeballs on my articles. I need to post them to every social media possible, and I need to tout them so that they are successful. And if I feel uncomfortable doing that, because I know that it will be viewed as braggy, then how am I going to get credit for my ideas and eyeballs on my stories? So women struggle with this because where a man can typically brag and, you know, we may not love it, but we're okay with it. When a woman brags, we dislike her. We view her as, you know, overly braggy or too cocky and boastful. And so there has to be some way around this. So the trick I've come up with in the book, and this comes out of a real experience of myself and a female colleague when I was at Newsweek, is you find a boast bitch. And this is a person who boasts for you and you boast for her. And as a result, you each get credit. And it's so hard for women to self-promote, but if somebody else is doing it on your behalf, then she is likely going to look like a great colleague and a team player, and you're going to get credit for your work. So I would literally do this in my previous job where she would do something great, and I would write an email, and I would CC all the bosses and talk about in a really lovely way how wonderful this thing that my friend Jessie had done. And suddenly they would notice, and she wouldn't have to come off like the braggy one.
Right. I think that's a great solution. In Feminist Fight Club, you created a new vocabulary for the sexist archetypes women encounter every day. Let's look at a couple of those. Manterrupter. Oh, gosh, I know so many of these.
Right. And Donald Trump, the ultimate manterrupter these days. So a manterrupter is the man who interrupts a woman when she's trying to speak. And in fact, this is rooted in social science research. Women are twice as likely to be interrupted when they speak as men are.
Isn't that interesting? And another one is bro-propriator.
Yes. So this is the bro who appropriates your idea. And no, these terms are meant to be playful, but each one is rooted in social science research. So again, even in mixed gender settings where an idea comes from a group, it emerges, actually both women and men are frequently likely to attribute that idea to a man because we instinctively assume that good ideas come from men. So this is the concept that you have a great idea, you put it forward, and then perhaps a man repeats it, and suddenly we think it's his idea.
Right. So let's look at a couple of solutions for the two we've just talked about. If you're in a meeting, and I'm sure most of us have been there, when somebody, a man, is interrupting a woman leading the meeting or not leading the meeting, how do we cope with that? What do we do?
Well, I think that bystanders can jump in. You know, again, much like with the bragging thing, it's tricky to be a woman being interrupted and then say, hey, can you let me finish? Because it's very easy to be perceived as too sensitive or bitchy or unable to take a joke. But if you interrupt on my behalf and say, hey, I wanted to hear what Jess had to say, can you let her finish? Then you look like a good colleague and I get to say my point. And the same goes for the bro-appropriation. If an idea is incorrectly attributed to somebody else, it's very easy as another person in that meeting to jump in and say, hey, I really liked that when Jess said it, or whatever it may be. And in fact, there was a really fascinating piece in the Washington Post recently about how the women of the White House were employing some of these tactics. And what they were finding is that even in a White House where the president calls himself a feminist, they felt that they were not being heard in meetings. So they created this term called amplification. And what that meant was, when one would be invited to a meeting, they would make sure that the others were also present. And what the research shows is that if there are more than 25% of women in a room, then women actually feel more inclined to speak up and their ideas are more likely to be heard. So first, they would get more women into that room. And once they were there, they would interrupt on each other's behalf so that they could make points. And they would repeat each other's ideas and amplify them, repeating again who originally came up with them. So drawing credit back to the author. And to me, that was just such a fascinating example that even the women in the highest office in the land are having to employ some of these tactics.
Yeah, it's very surprising. Very quickly, and if you can do this in 30 seconds, this is such a huge issue in today's economy when well-qualified women, and yes, it does happen to men, but I think women are more impacted by it, when they're seen as too old.
Right. This is so tricky. And what we've found after the most recent recession is that it is women over 50 who, in fact, have the most trouble getting back into the workplace. This was a tough one for me to deal with because there's not a lot of social science research around it. And so I interviewed a lot of older women who essentially said, you know, I am wise and I have learned over time that I'm going to just be myself and do me. And so there was this sense of, I'm not sure what the swearing policy on this show is, but zero F's given above a certain age. And I think that a lot of women try to employ that, because what are you supposed to do? Ageism is very real in this country, and it affects women more strongly.
Mm. Well, lots of really great practical advice in this book. Each chapter has a segment you call the Fight Moves, where you discuss the best practices in certain situations. Very interesting and great talking with you, Jessica Bennett. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And the book, again, is called Feminist Fight Club, an office survival manual for a sexist workplace. And you can find out more about Jessica Bennett and her work at feministfightclub.com, feministfightclub.com. And that brings us right up to the end of today's show. Thanks for being with us. We appreciate you spending this hour on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. You can find me at 800-495-7617, 800-495-7617. You can also find me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair, Facebook at Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, and at conversationslive.net. We'll see you next week. Until then, live well, live strong.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.